and there was some great national celebration in town, judging by the firecrackers, veritable bombs that exploded all the time, and at 2:05 PM I heard the sound of whistling lips nearing the half-open door of my cabin, and then a thump upon it. It was Big Frank. He remained framed in the open door, one hand on its jamb, leaning forward a little. Howdy. Nurse Law was on the telephone. She wanted to know, was I better, and would I come today? At 20 paces, Frank used to look a mountain of health. At 5, as now, he was a ruddy mosaic of scars. Had been blown through a wall overseas. But despite nameless injuries, he was able to man a tremendous truck, fish, hunt, drink, and buoyantly dally with roadside ladies. That day, either because it was such a great holiday or simply because he wanted to divert a sick man, he had taken off the glove he usually wore on his left hand, the one pressing against the side of the door, and revealed to the fascinated sufferer not only an entire lack of fourth and fifth fingers, but also a naked girl with cinnabar nipples and indigo delta, charmingly tattooed on the back of his crippled hand, its index and middle digit making her legs, while his wrist bore her flower-crowned head. Oh, delicious, reclining against the woodwork like some sly fairy. I asked him to tell Mary Law I would stay in bed all day and would get in touch with my daughter sometime tomorrow if I felt probably Polynesian. He noticed the direction of my gaze and made her right hip twitch amorously. Okie dokie, Big Frank sang out, slapped the jam, and whistling, carried my message away, and I went on drinking. And by morning the fever was gone. And although I was as limp as a toad, I put on the purple dressing gown over my maize yellow pyjamas and walked over to the office telephone. Everything was fine? A bright voice informed me that yes, everything was fine. My daughter had checked out the day before, around 2. Her uncle, Mr. Gustav, had called for her with a cocker spaniel pup and a smile for everyone, and a black Cadillac, and had paid Dolly's bill in cash, and told them to tell me I should not worry, and keep warm, they were at Grandpa's ranch, as agreed. Elphiston was, and I hope still is, a very cute little town. It was spread like a maquette, you know, with its neat green-walled trees and red-roofed houses over the valley floor, and I think I have alluded earlier to its model school and temple and spacious rectangular block, some of which were, curiously enough, just unconventional pastures with a mule or a unicorn grazing in the young July morning mist. Very amusing. At one gravel-groaning sharp turn I sideswiped a parked car, but said to myself telestically and telepathically, I hoped, to its gesticulating owner, that I would return later. Address Bird School, Bird, New Bird. The gin kept my heart alive, but bemazed my brain. And after some lapses and losses common to dream sequences, I found myself in the reception room, trying to beat up the doctor, and roaring at people under chairs, and clamouring for Mary, who luckily for her was not there. Rough hands plucked at my dressing gown, ripping off a pocket, and somehow I seemed to have been sitting on a bald, brown-headed patient, whom I had mistaken for Dr. Blue, and who eventually stood up, remarking with a preposterous accent, "Now who is neurotic, I ask?" And then a gaunt, unsmiling nurse presented me with 7 beautiful, beautiful books and the exquisitely folded tartan lap-robe and demanded a receipt. And in the sudden silence I became aware of a policeman in the hallway, to whom my fellow motorist was pointing me out, and I meekly signed the very symbolic receipt, thus surrendering my Lolita to all those apes. But what else could I do? One simple and stark thought stood out, and this was, freedom for the moment is everything. One false move, and I might have been made to explain a life of crime. So I simulated a coming out of a daze. To my fellow motorist, I paid what he thought was fair. To Dr. Blue, who by then was stroking my hand, I spoke in tears of the liquor I bolstered too freely a tricky but not necessarily diseased heart with. To the hospital in general I apologized with a flourish that almost bowled me over, adding, however, that I was not on particularly good terms with the rest of the Humbert clan. To myself I whispered that I still had my gun and was still a free man, free to trace the fugitive, free to destroy my brother. 1,000-mile stretch of silk-smooth road separated Casbeam, where, to the best of my belief, the Red Fiend had been scheduled to appear for the first time, and fateful Elphinstone, which we had reached about a week before Independence Day. The journey had taken up most of June, for we had seldom made more than 150 miles per travelling day, spending the rest of the time, up to 5 days in one case, at various stopping places, all of them also prearranged, no doubt. It was that stretch, then, along which the fiend's spoor should be sought, and to this I devoted myself, after several unmentionable days of dashing up and down the relentlessly radiating roads in the vicinity of Elphinstone. Imagine me, reader, with my shyness, my distaste for any ostentation, my inherent sense of the comme il imagine me masking the frenzy of my grief with a trembling, ingratiating smile, while devising some casual pretext to flip through the hotel register. "Oh," I would say, "I'm almost positive that I stayed here once. Let me look up the entries for mid-June." "Oh, no. I see I'm wrong after all. What a quaint name for a hometown, Quartergain. Thanks very much." Or, "I had a customer staying here. I mislaid his address. May I..." And every once in a while, especially if the operator of the place happened to be a certain type of gloomy male, personal inspection of the books was denied me. I have a memo here. Between July 5th and November 18th, when I returned to Beardsley for a few days, I registered, if not actually stayed, at 342 hotels, motels and tourist homes. This figure includes a few registrations between Chestnut and Beardsley, one of which yielded a shadow of the fiend, en Petit Larousse Hill. I had to space and time my inquiries carefully, so as not to attract undue attention, and there must have been at least 50 places where I merely inquired at the desk, but that was a futile quest, and I preferred building up a foundation of verisimilitude and goodwill by first paying for an unneeded room. My survey showed that of the 300 or so books inspected, at least 20 provided me with a clue. The loitering fiend had stopped even more often than we, or else. He was quite capable of that. He had thrown in additional registrations in order to keep me well furnished with derisive hints. Only in one case had he actually stayed at the same motor court as we, a few paces from Lolita's pillow. In some instances, he had taken up quarters in the same or in a neighbouring block. Not infrequently, he had lain in wait at an intermediate spot between two bespoken points. How vividly I recalled Lolita, just before our departure from Beardsley, prone on the parlour rug, studying tour books and maps and marking laps and stops with her lipstick. I discovered at once that he had foreseen my investigations and had planted insulting pseudonyms for my special benefit. At the very first motel office I visited, Ponderosa Lodge, his entry among a dozen obviously human ones read, "Dr. Graciana Forbeson, Mirandola, New York." Its Italian comedy connotations could not fail to strike me, of course. The landlady deigned to inform me that the gentleman had been laid up for 5 days with a bad cold, and that he had left his car for repairs in some garage or other, and that he had checked out on the 4th of July. Yes, a girl called Anne Law had worked formerly at the lodge, and was now married to a grocer in Cedar City. One moonlit night I waylaid white-shoed Mary in a solitary street. An automaton, she was about to shriek, but I managed to humanize her by the simple act of falling on my knees and with pious yelps imploring her to help. She did not know a thing, she swore. Who was this Graciano Forbeson? She seemed to waver. I whipped out a $100 bill. She lifted it to the light of the moon.
"He is your brother," she whispered at last.
I plucked the bill out of her moon-cold hand and, spitting out a French curse, turned and ran away. This taught me to rely on myself alone. No detective could discover the clue's trap attuned to my mind and manner. I could not hope, of course, he would ever leave his correct name and address, but I did hope he might slip on the glaze of his own subtlety, by daring, say, to introduce a richer and more personal shot of colour than was strictly necessary, or by revealing too much through a qualitative sum of quantitative parts which revealed too little. In one thing he succeeded. He succeeded in thoroughly enmeshing me and my thrashing anguish in his demoniacal game. With infinite skill he swayed and staggered and regained an impossible balance, always leaving me with a sportive hope, if I may use such a term in speaking of betrayal, fury, desolation, horror and hate, that he might give himself away next time. He never did, though coming damn close to it. We all admire the spangled acrobat with classical grace, meticulously walking his tight rope in the talcum light. But how much rarer art there is in the sagging rope expert, wearing scarecrow clothes and impersonating a grotesque drunk. I should know. The clues he left did not establish his identity, but they reflected his personality, or at least a certain homogeneous and striking personality. His genre, his type of humour, at its best at least, the tone of his brain, had affinities with my own. He mimed and mocked me.
His allusions were definitely highbrow. He was well-read. He knew French. He was versed in logodidily and logomancy. He was an amateur of sex law. He had a feminine handwriting. He would change his name, but he could not disguise, no matter how he slanted them, his very peculiar T's, W's and L's. Kelkapart Island was one of his favourite residences. He did not use a fountain pen, which fact, as any psychoanalyst will tell you, meant that the patient was a repressed undinist. One mercifully hopes there are water nymphs in the Styx. His main trait was his passion for tantalization. Goodness, what a tease the poor fellow was. He challenged my scholarship. I am sufficiently proud of my knowing something to be modest about my not knowing all, and I dare say I missed some elements of that cryptogramic paper chase. What a shiver of triumph and loathing shook my frail frame when, among the plain innocent names in the hotel recorder, his fiendish conundrum would ejaculate in my face. I noticed that whenever he felt his enigmas were becoming too recondite, even for such a solver as I, he would lure me back with an easy one. Arsène Lupin was obvious to a Frenchman who remembered the detective stories of his youth, and one hardly had to be a Coleridgean to appreciate the trite poke of a person, Porlock, England. In horrible taste, but basically suggestive of a cultured man, not a policeman, not a common goon, not a lewd salesman, were such assumed names as Arthur Rainbow, plainly the travestied author of Le Bateau Bleu. Let me laugh a little too, gentlemen. And Maurice Schmetterling of L'Oiseau Ivre fame. Touché, reader. The silly but funny D. Organ, Elmira, New York, was from Molière, of course, and because I had quite recently tried to interest Lolita in a famous 18th-century play, I welcomed as an old friend Harry Bumper, Sheridan, Wyoming. An ordinary encyclopedia informed me who the peculiar-looking Phineas Quimby, Lebanon, New Hampshire, was, and any good Freudian, with a German name and some interest in religious prostitution, should recognise at a glance the implication of Dr. Kitzler, Eric's miss. So far, so good. That sort of fun was shoddy, but on the whole impersonal and thus innocuous. Among entries that arrested my attention as undoubtable clues per se, but baffled me in respect of their finer points, I do not care to mention many, since I feel I am groping in a borderland mist with verbal phantoms turning perhaps into living vacationists. Who was Johnny Randall, Ramble, Ohio? Or was he a real person who just happened to write a hand similar to N.S. Aristoff, Cattagula, New York? What was the sting in Cattagula? And what about James Maver Morrell, Hoxton, England? Aristophanes, hoax, fine, but what was I missing? There was one strain running through all that pseudonymity which caused me especially painful palpitations when I came across it. Such things as G. Trap, Geneva, New York, was the sign of treachery on Lolita's part. Aubrey Beardsley, Kelkapart Island, suggested more lucidly than the garbled telephone message had that the starting point of the affair should be looked for in the East. Lucas Picador, Merime Parr, insinuated that my Carmen had betrayed my pathetic endearments to the impostor. Horribly cruel, forsooth, was Will Brown, Dolores Collo. The gruesome Harold Hayes, Tombstone, Arizona, which at another time would have appealed to my sense of humour, implied a familiarity with the girl's past that in nightmare fashion suggested for a moment that my quarry was an old friend of the family, maybe an old flame of Charlotte's, maybe a redresser of wrongs. Donald Quick's Sierra Nevada. But the most penetrating bodkin was the anagram-tailed entry in the Register of Chestnut Lodge, Ted Hunter, Kane, New Hampshire. The garbled license numbers left by all these persons and organs and morels and traps only told me that the motel keepers omit to check if guests' cars are accurately listed. References incompletely or incorrectly indicated to the cars the fiend had hired for short laps between Wace and Elphinstone were, of course, useless. The license of the initial Aztec was a shimmer of shifting numerals, some transposed, others altered or omitted, but somehow forming interrelated combinations, such as WS1564 and SH1616 and Q328888 or CU88322, which, however, were so cunningly contrived as to never reveal a common denominator. It occurred to me that after he had turned that convertible over to accomplices in Wace and switched to the stage motorcar system, his successors might have been less careful and might have inscribed at some hotel office the archetype of those interrelated figures. But if looking for the fiend along a road I knew he had taken was such a complicated, vague and unprofitable business, what could I expect from any attempt to trace unknown motorists travelling along unknown routes?
By the time I reached Beardsley, in the course of the harrowing recapitulation I have now discussed at sufficient length, a complete image had formed in my mind, and through the always risky process of elimination, I had reduced this image to the only concrete source that morbid cerebration and torpid memory could give it. Except for the Reverend Rigor Mortis, as the girls called him, and an old gentleman who taught non-obligatory German and Latin, there were no regular male teachers at Beardsley School. But on two occasions, an art instructor on the Beardsley College faculty had come over to show the schoolgirls magic lantern pictures of French castles and 19th-century paintings. I had wanted to attend those projections and talks, but Dolly, as was her wont, had asked me not to, period. I also remembered that Gaston had referred to that particular lecturer as a brilliant garçon. But that was all. Memory refused to supply me with the name of the chateau lover. On the day fixed for the execution, I walked through the sleet across the campus to the information desk in Maker Hall, Beardsley College. There I learned that the fellow's name was Riggs, rather like that of the minister, that he was a bachelor, and that in 10 minutes he would issue from the museum where he was having a class. In the passage leading to the auditorium, I sat on a marble bench of sorts donated by Cecilia Dalrymple Ramble. As I waited there, in prostatic discomfort, drunk, sleep-starved, with my gun in my fist and my raincoat pocket, it suddenly occurred to me that I was demented and was about to do something stupid. There was not one chance in a million that Albert Riggs, assistant professor, was hiding my Lolita at his Beardsley home, 24 Pritchard Road. He could not be the villain. It was absolutely preposterous. I was losing my time and my wits. He and she were in California and not here at all. Presently, I noticed a vague commotion behind some white statues. A door, not the one I had been staring at, opened briskly, and amid a bevy of women students, a baldish head and two bright brown eyes bobbed, advanced. He was a total stranger to me, but insisted we had met at a lawn party at Beardsley School. How was my delightful tennis-playing daughter? He had another class. He would be seeing me. Another attempt at identification was less speedily resolved. Through an advertisement in one of Lowe's magazines, I dared to get in touch with a private detective, an ex-pugilist, and merely to give him some idea of the method adopted by the fiend, I acquainted him with the kind of names and addresses I had collected. He demanded a goodish deposit, and for 2 years, 2 years, reader, that imbecile busied himself with checking those nonsense data. I had long severed all monetary relations with him when he turned up one day with the triumphant information that an 80-year-old Indian by the name of Bill Brown lived near Dolores, Colorado. This book is about Lolita. And now that I have reached the part which, had I not been forestalled by another internal combustion martyr, might be called Dolores Disparu, there would be little sense in analysing the 3 empty years that followed. While a few pertinent points have to be marked, the general impression I desire to convey is of a side door crashing open in life's full flight, and a rush of roaring black time drowning with its whipping wind the cry of lone disaster. Singularly enough, I seldom, if ever, dreamed of Lolita as I remembered her, as I saw her constantly and obsessively in my conscious mind during my daymares and insomnias. More precisely, she did haunt my sleep, but she appeared there in strange and ludicrous disguises as Valeria or Charlotte, or a cross between them. That complex ghost would come to me, shedding shift after shift, in an atmosphere of great melancholy and disgust, and would recline in dull invitation on some narrow board or hard settee, with flesh ajar like the rubber valve of a soccer ball's bladder. I would find myself, dentures fractured or hopelessly mislaid, in horrible chambre garnie, where I would be entertained at tedious vivisecting parties that generally ended with Charlotte or Valeria weeping in my bleeding arms and being tenderly kissed by my brotherly lips in a dream disorder of auctioneered Viennese bric-a-brac, pity, impotence, and the brown wigs of tragic old women who had just been gassed. One day I removed from the car and destroyed an accumulation of teen magazines, you know the sort. Stone Age at heart, up to date, or at least Mycenaean, as to hygiene. A handsome, very ripe actress with huge lashes and a pulpy red underlip endorsing a shampoo. Ads and fads. Young scholars dote on plenty of pleats. Que c'était loin tout cela. It is your hostess's duty to provide robes. Unattached details take all the sparkle out of your conversation. All of us have known pickers, one who picks her cuticle at the office party. Unless he is very elderly or very important, a man should remove his gloves before shaking hands with a woman. Invite romance by wearing the exciting new tummy flattener. Trims tums, nips hips. Tristram in movie land, yes sir. The Joro marital enigma is making yaps flap. Glamorize yourself quickly and inexpensively. Comics. Bad girl, dark hair, fat father, cigar. Good girl, red hair, handsome dadums, clipped moustache. Or that repulsive strip with the big gagoon and his wife, a kiddoid nomad. Et moi, qui t'offrais mon génie. I recalled the rather charming nonsense verse I used to write her when she was a child. Nonsense, she used to say mockingly, is correct. The squirrel and his squirrel, the rabs and their rabbits, have certain obscure and peculiar habits. Male hummingbirds make the most exquisite rockets. The snake, when he walks, holds his hands in his pockets. Other things of hers were harder to relinquish. Up to the end of 1949, I cherished and adored, and stained with my kisses and merman tears, a pair of old sneakers, a boy's shirt she had worn, some ancient blue jeans I found in the trunk compartment, a crumpled school cap, such like wanton treasures. Then, when I understood my mind was cracking, I collected these sundry belongings, added to them what had been stored in Beardsley, a box of books, a bicycle, old coats, galoshes, and on her 15th birthday mailed everything as an anonymous gift to a home for orphaned girls on a windy lake on the Canadian border. It is just possible that, had I gone to a strong hypnotist, he might have extracted from me, and arrayed in a logical pattern, certain chance memories that I have threaded through my book, with considerably more ostentation than they present themselves with to my mind even now, when I know what to seek in the past. At the time, I felt I was merely losing contact with reality. And after spending the rest of the winter and most of the following spring in a Quebec sanatorium where I had stayed before, I resolved first to settle some affairs of mine in New York, and then to proceed to California for a thorough search there. Here is something I composed in my retreat. Wanted, wanted, Dolores Hayes, hair brown, lips scarlet. Age, 5,300 days. Profession, none, all starlet. Where are you hiding, Dolores Hayes? Why are you hiding, darling? I talk in a daze, I walk in a maze. I cannot get out, said the starling. Where are you riding, Dolores Hayes? What make is the magic carpet? Is a cream cougar the present craze? And where are you parked, my carpet? Who is your hero, Dolores Hayes? Still one of those blue-caped starmen? Oh, the balmy days and the palmy bays, and the cars and the bars, my Carmen. Oh, Dolores, that jukebox hurts. Are you still dancing, darling? Both in worn Levi's, both in torn T-shirts, and I in my corner snarling. Happy, happy is gnarled McFate, touring the States with a child-wife, ploughing his molly in every state, among the protected wildlife. My dolly, my folly, her eyes were there, and never closed when I kissed her. Know an old perfume called Soleil Vert? Are you from Paris, mister? L'autre soir un air froid d'opéra malita, son fêlé bien folle qui s'y fit. Il neige, le décor s'écroule, Lolita, Lolita, que je fais de ta vie? Dying, dying, Lolita Hayes, of hate and remorse I'm dying. And again my hairy fist I raise, and again I hear you crying. Officer, officer, there they go, in the rain where that lighted store is. And her socks are white, and I love her so, and her name is Hayes Dolores. Officer, officer, there they are, Dolores Hayes and her lover. Whip out your gun and follow that car, now tumble out and take cover. Wanted, wanted, Dolores Hayes, her dream-grey gaze never flinches. 90 pounds is all she weighs, with a height of 60 inches. My car is limping, Dolores Hayes, and the last long lap is the hardest. and I shall be dumped where the weed decays, and the rest is rust and stardust. By psychoanalyzing this poem, I note it is really a maniac's masterpiece. The stark, stiff, lurid rhymes correspond very exactly to certain perspectiveless and terrible landscapes and figures, and magnified parts of landscapes and figures, as drawn by psychopaths in tests devised by their astute trainers. I wrote many more poems. I immersed myself in the poetry of others. But not for a second did I forget the load of revenge. I would be a knave to say, and the reader a fool to believe, that the shock of losing Lolita cured me of pederosis. My accursed nature could not change, no matter how my love for her did. On playgrounds and beaches, my sullen and stealthy eye, against my will, still sought out the flash of a nymphet's limbs, the sly tokens of Lolita's handmaids and rose girls. But one essential vision in me had withered. Never did I dwell now on possibilities of bliss with a little maiden, specific or synthetic, in some out-of-the-way place. Never did my fancy sink its fangs into Lolita's sisters, far, far away in the coves of evoked islands. That was all over, for the time being at least. On the other hand, alas, 2 years of monstrous indulgence had left me with certain habits of lust. I feared lest the void I lived in might drive me to plunge into the freedom of sudden insanity when confronted with a chance temptation in some lane between school and supper. Solitude was corrupting me. I needed company and care. My heart was a hysterical, unreliable organ. This is how Rita enters the picture. She was twice Lolita's age and 3/4 of mine, a very slight, dark-haired, pale-skinned adult, weighing 105 pounds, with charmingly asymmetrical eyes, an angular, rapidly sketched profile, and a most appealing encelure to her supple back. I think she had some Spanish or Babylonian blood. I picked her up one depraved May evening, somewhere between Montreal and New York, or, more narrowly, between Toylestown and Blake, at a darkishly burning bar under the sign of the Tiger Moth, where she was amiably drunk. She insisted we had gone to school together, and she placed her trembling little hand on my ape paw. My senses were very slightly stirred, but I decided to give her a try. I did, and adopted her as a constant companion. She was so kind, was Rita, such a good sport, that I dare say she would have given herself to any pathetic creature or fallacy, an old broken tree or a bereaved porcupine, out of sheer chumminess and compassion. When I first met her, she had but recently divorced her third husband, and a little more recently had been abandoned by her seventh cavalier servant. The others, the mutables, were too numerous and mobile to tabulate. Her brother was, and no doubt still is, a prominent pasty-faced, suspenders-and-painted, tie-wearing politician, mayor and booster of his ball-playing, Bible-reading, grain-handling hometown. For the last 8 years he had been paying his great little sister several $100 per month under the stringent condition that she would never, never enter the great little grain ball city. She told me with wails of wonder that for some goddamn reason every new boyfriend of hers would first of all take her grain ball wood. It was a fatal attraction. And before she knew what was what, she would find herself being sucked into the lunar orbit of the town, and would be following the floodlit drive that encircled it, going round and round, as she phrased it, like a goddamn mulberry moth. She had a natty little coupe, and in it we travelled to California so as to give my venerable vehicle a rest. Her natural speed was 90. Dear Rita, we cruised together for 2 dim years, from summer 1950 to summer 1952, and she was the sweetest, simplest, gentlest, dumbest Rita imaginable. In comparison to her, Valechka was a Schlegel, and Charlotte a Hegel. There's no earthly reason why I should dally with her in the margin of this sinister memoir, but let me say, hi, Rita, wherever you are, drunk or hangoverish, Rita, hi. That she was the most soothing, the most comprehending companion that I ever had, and certainly saved me from the madhouse. I told her I was trying to trace a girl and plug that girl's bully. Rita solemnly approved of the plan, and in the course of some investigation she undertook on her own, without really knowing a thing, around San Humbertino, got entangled with a pretty awful crook herself. I had the devil of a time retrieving her, used and bruised, but still cocky. Then one day she proposed playing Russian roulette with my sacred automatic. I said you couldn't, it was not a revolver, and we struggled for it until at last it went off, touching off a very thin and very comical spurt of hot water from the hole it made in the wall of the cabin room. I remember her shrieks of laughter. The oddly prepubescent curve of her back, her ricey skin, her slow, languorous columbine kisses kept me from mischief. It is not the artistic aptitudes that are secondary sexual characters, as some shams and shamans have said. It is the other way round. Sex is but the ancillary of art. One rather mysterious spree that had interesting repercussions I must notice. I had abandoned the search. The fiend was either in Tartary or burning away in my cerebellum, the flames fanned by my fancy and grief, but certainly not having Dolores Hayes play champion tennis on the Pacific coast. One afternoon, on our way back east, in a hideous hotel, the kind where they hold conventions and where labelled fat pink men stagger around, all first names and business and booze, dear Rita and I awoke to find a third in our room, a blonde, almost albino young fellow with white eyelashes and large transparent ears, whom neither Rita nor I recalled ever having seen in our sad lives. Sweating in thick, dirty underwear, and with old army boots on, he lay snoring on the double bed beyond my chaste Rita. One of his front teeth was gone, amber pustules grew on his forehead. Ritochka enveloped her sinuous nudity in my raincoat, the first thing at hand. I slipped on a pair of candy-striped drawers, and we took stock of the situation. 5 glasses had been used, which, in the way of clues, was an embarrassment of riches. The door was not properly closed. A sweater and a pair of shapeless tan pants lay on the floor. We shook their owner into miserable consciousness. He was completely amnesic. In an accent that Rita recognized as pure Brooklynese, he peevishly insinuated that somehow we had purloined his worthless identity. We rushed him into his clothes and left him at the nearest hospital, realizing on the way that somehow or other, after forgotten gyrations, we were in grain ball. Half a year later, Rita wrote the doctor for news. Jack Humbertson, as he had been tastelessly dubbed, was still isolated from his personal past. Oh, Mnemosyne, sweetest and most mischievous of muses! I would not have mentioned this incident had it not started a chain of ideas that resulted in my publishing in the Cantrip Review an essay on Mimia and Memory, in which I suggested, among other things that seemed original and important to that splendid review's benevolent readers, a theory of perceptual time based on the circulation of the blood, and conceptually depending, to fill up this nutshell, on the mind's being conscious not only of matter, but also of its own self, thus creating a continuous spanning of 2 points, the storable future and the stored past. In result of this venture, and in culmination of the impression made by my previous travaux, I was called from New York, where Rita and I were living in a little flat with a view of gleaming children taking shower baths far below in a fountainous arbour of Central Park, to Cantrip College, 400 miles away, for 1 year. I lodged there in special apartments for poets and philosophers from September 1951 to June 1952, while Rita, whom I preferred not to display, vegetated somewhat indecorously, I'm afraid, in a roadside inn where I visited her twice a week. Then she vanished, more humanely than her predecessor had done. A month later I found her in the local jail. She was très digne, had had her appendix removed, and managed to convince me that the beautiful bluish furs she had been accused of stealing from a Mrs. Roland McCrum had really been a spontaneous, if somewhat alcoholic, gift from Roland himself. I succeeded in getting her out without appealing to her touchy brother, and soon afterwards we drove back to Central Park West by way of Briceland, where we had stopped for a few hours the year before. A curious urge to relive my stay there with Lolita had got hold of me. I was entering a phase of existence where I had given up all hope of tracing her kidnapper and her. I now attempted to fall back on old settings in order to save what still could be saved in a way of souvenir. Souvenir comme vertu. Autumn was ringing in the air. To a postcard requesting twin beds, Professor Hamburg got a prompt expression of regret in reply. They were full up. They had one bathless basement room with 4 beds, which they thought I would not want. Their notepaper was headed, "The Enchanted Hunters, near churches, no dogs, all legal beverages. I wondered if this last statement was true. All? Did they have, for instance, sidewalk grenadine? I also wondered if a hunter, enchanted or otherwise, would not need a pointer more than a pew. And with a spasm of pain I recalled a scene worthy of a great artist, Petite Nymphe accroupie. But that silky cocker-spaniel had perhaps been a baptized one. No, I felt I could not endure the throes of revisiting that lobby. There was a much better possibility of retrievable time elsewhere in soft, rich-coloured autumnal Bryceland. Leaving Rita in a bar, I made for the town library. A twittering spinster was only too glad to help me disinter mid-August 1947 from the bound Bryceland Gazette, and presently, in a secluded nook under a naked light, I was turning the enormous and fragile pages of a coffin-black volume almost as big as Lolita. Reader, Bruder, what a foolish Hamburg that Hamburg was. Since his super-sensitive system was loath to face the actual scene, he thought he could at least enjoy a secret part of it, which reminds one of the 10th or 20th soldier in the raping queue, who throws the girl's black shawl over her white face so as not to see those impossible eyes while taking his military pleasure in the sad, sacked village. What I lusted to get was the printed picture that had chanced to absorb my trespassing image while the Gazette's photographer was concentrating on Dr. Braddock and his group. Passionately I hoped to find preserved the portrait of the artist as a younger brute. An innocent camera catching me on my dark way to Lolita's bed. What a magnet for Mnemosyne. I cannot well explain the true nature of that urge of mine. It was allied, I suppose, to that swooning curiosity which impels one to examine with a magnifying glass bleak little figures, still life practically, and everybody about to throw up, at an early morning execution, and the patient's expression impossible to make out in the print. Anyway, I was literally gasping for breath, and one corner of the Book of Doom kept stabbing me in the stomach while I scanned and skimmed. Brute Force and Possessed were coming on Sunday the 24th to both theatres. Mr. Purdom, independent tobacco auctioneer, said that ever since 1925 he had been an Omen Fastum smoker. Husky Hank and his petite bride were to be the guests of Mr. and Mrs. Reginald G. Gore, 58 Inchkeith Avenue. The size of certain parasites is 1/6 of the host. Dunkirk was fortified in the 10th century. Mrs. Sock, 39 cents. Saddle Oxford, 3.98. Wine, 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 quipped the author of Dark Age, who refused to be photographed, may suit a Persian bubble bird, but I say give me rain, rain, rain on the shingle roof for roses and inspiration every time. Dimples are caused by the adherence of skin to the deeper tissues. Greeks repulse a heavy gorilla assault. Ah, at last, a little figure in white, and Dr. Braddock in black. But whatever spectral shoulder was brushing against his ample form, nothing of myself could I make out. I went to find Rita, who introduced me with her vain, triste smile to a pocket-sized, wizened, truculently tight old man, saying this was, what was the name again, son? A former schoolmate of hers. He tried to retain her, and in the slight scuffle that followed, I hurt my thumb against his hard head. In the silent, painted park where I walked her and aired her a little, she sobbed and said I would soon, soon leave her as everybody had, and I sang her a wistful French ballad and strung together some fugitive rhymes to amuse her. The place was called Enchanted Hunter's Query. What Indian dyes, Diana, did thy dell endorse to make a picture lake a very bloodbath of trees before the Blue Hotel? She said, why blue when it is white? Why blue, for heaven's sake, and started to cry again. And I marched her to the car, and we drove on to New York. And soon she was reasonably happy again, high up in the haze on the little terrace of our flat. I notice I have somehow mixed up two events, my visit with Rita to Bryceland on our way to Cantrip, and our passing through Bryceland again on our way back to New York. But such suffusions of swimming colours are not to be disdained by the artist in recollection. My letterbox in the entrance hall belonged to the type that allows one to glimpse something of its contents through a glassed slit. Several times already, a trick of harlequin light that fell through the glass upon an alien handwriting had twisted it into a semblance of Lolita's script, causing me almost to collapse as I leant against an adjacent urn, almost my own. Whenever that happened, whenever her lovely, loopy, childish scrawl was horribly transformed into the dull hand of one of my few correspondents. I used to recollect with anguished amusement the times in my trustful pre-DeLorean past, when I would be misled by a jewel-bright window opposite wherein my lurking eye, the ever-alert periscope of my shameful vice, would make out from afar a half-naked nymphette stilled in the act of combing her Alice in Wonderland hair. There was in the fiery phantasm a perfection which made my wild delight also perfect, just because the vision was out of reach, with no possibility of attainment to spoil it by the awareness of an appended taboo. Indeed, it may well be that the very attraction immaturity has for me lies not so much in the limpidity of pure young forbidden fairy-child beauty, as in the security of a situation where infinite perfections fill the gap between the little given and the great promised. The great rose-grey never to be had. Mes fenêtres. Hanging above blotched sunset and welling night, grinding my teeth, I would crowd all the demons of my desire against the railing of a throbbing balcony. It would be ready to take off in the apricot and black humid evening, did take off, whereupon the lighted image would move, and Eve would revert to a rib. And there would be nothing in the window but an obese, partly clad man reading the paper. Since I sometimes won the race between my fancy and nature's reality, the deception was bearable. Unbearable pain began when chance entered the fray and deprived me of the smile meant for me. "Savez-vous qu'à 10 ans ma petite était folle de vous?" said a woman I talked to at tea in Paris. And the petite had just married, miles away, and I couldn't even remember if I'd ever noticed her in that garden next to those tennis courts 12 years before. And now, likewise, the radiant foreglimpse, the promise of reality, a promise not only to be simulated seductively, but also to be nobly held, all this chance denied me. Chance and a change to smaller characters on the pale beloved writer's part. My fancy was both Proustianized and Procrustianized. For that particular morning, late in September 1952, as I had come down to grope for my mail, the dapper and bilious janitor with whom I was on execrable terms started to complain that a man who had seen Rita home recently had been sick like a dog on the front steps. In the process of listening to him and tipping him and then listening to a revised and politer version of the incident, I had the impression that one of the two letters which that blessed mail brought was from Rita's mother, a crazy little woman whom we had once visited on Cape Cod, and who kept writing to me in my various addresses saying how wonderfully well-matched her daughter and I were, and how wonderful it would be if we married. The other letter, which I opened and scanned rapidly in the elevator, was from John Farlow. I have often noticed that we are inclined to endow our friends with the stability of type that literary characters acquire in the reader's mind. No matter how many times we reopen King Lear, never shall we find the good king banging his tankard in high revelry, all woes forgotten, at a jolly reunion with all three daughters and their lapdogs. Never will Emma rally, revived by the sympathetic salts in Flaubert's father's timely tear. Whatever evolution this or that popular character has gone through between the book covers, his fate is fixed in our minds. And similarly, we expect our friends to follow this or that logical and conventional pattern we have fixed for them. Thus X will never compose the immortal music that would clash with the second-rate symphonies he has accustomed us to. Y will never commit murder. Under no circumstances can Z ever betray us. We have it all arranged in our minds. And the less often we see a particular person, the more satisfying it is to check how obediently he conforms to our notion of him every time we hear him. Any deviation in the fates we have ordained would strike us as not only anomalous, but unethical. We would prefer not to have known at all our neighbour, the retired hot dog stand operator, if it turns out he has just produced the greatest book of poetry his age has seen. I am saying all this in order to explain how bewildered I was by Farlow's hysterical letter. I knew his wife had died, but I certainly expected him to remain, throughout a devout widowhood, the dull, sedate, and reliable person he had always been. Now he wrote that after a brief visit to the U.S. he had returned to South America, and had decided that whatever affairs he had controlled at Ramsdale he would hand over to Jack Windmuller of that town, a lawyer whom we both knew. He seemed particularly relieved to get rid of the Hayes complications. He had married a Spanish girl. He had stopped smoking and had gained 30 pounds. She was very young and a ski champion. They were going to India for their honeymoon soon. Since he was building a family, as he put it, he would have no time henceforth for my affairs, which he termed very strange and very aggravating. Busybodies, a whole committee of them, it appeared, had informed him that the whereabouts of little Dolly Hayes were unknown, and that I was living with a notorious divorcee in California. His father-in-law was a count and exceedingly wealthy. The people who had been renting the Hayes house for some years now wished to buy it. He suggested that I better produce Dolly quick. He had broken his leg. He enclosed a snapshot of himself and a brunette in white wool, beaming at each other among the snows of Chile. I remember letting myself into my flat and starting to say, "Well, at least we shall now track them down," when the other letter began talking to me in a small, matter-of-fact voice. "Dear Dad, how's everything? I'm married. I'm going to have a baby. I guess he's going to be a big one. I guess he'll come right before Christmas. This is a hard letter to write. I'm going nuts because we don't have enough to pay our debts and get out of here. Dick is promised a big job in Alaska in his very specialized corner of the mechanical field. That's all I know about it, but it's really grand. Pardon me for withholding our home address, but you may still be mad at me, and Dick must not know. This town is something. You can't see the morons for the smog. Please do send us a check, Dad. We could manage with 300 or 400 or even less. Anything is welcome. You might sell my old things, because once we get there, the dough will just start rolling in. Write, please. I have gone through much sadness and hardship. Yours expecting, Dolly. Mrs. Richard F. Schiller." I was again on the road, again at the wheel of the old blue sedan, again alone. Rita had been dead to the world when I read that letter and fought the mountains of agony it raised within me. I glanced at her as she smiled in her sleep and had kissed her on her moist brow and had left her forever, with a note of tender adieu which I taped to her navel, otherwise she might not have found it. Alone, did I say, pas tout à fait. I had my little black chum with me, and as soon as I reached a secluded spot, I rehearsed Mr. Richard F. Schiller's violent death. I had found a very old and very dirty grey sweater of mine in the back of the car, and this I hung up on a branch in a speechless glade, which I had reached by a wood road from the now remote highway. The carrying out of the sentence was a little marred by what seemed to me a certain stiffness in the play of the trigger, and I wondered if I should get some oil for the mysterious thing, but decided I had no time to spare. Back into the car went the old dead sweater, now with additional perforations, and having reloaded warm chum, I continued my journey. The letter was dated September 18th, 1952. This was September 22nd. And the address she gave was General Delivery, Colmont. Not VA, not PA, not 10. And not Colmont, anyway. I have camouflaged everything, my love. Inquiries showed this to be a small industrial community some 800 miles from New York City. At first I planned to drive all day and all night, but then thought better of it and rested for a couple of hours around dawn in a motor court room a few miles before reaching the town. I had made up my mind that the fiend, this Schiller, had been a car salesman who had perhaps got to know my Lolita by giving her a ride in Beardsley the day her bike blew a tire on the way to Miss Emperor, and that he had got into some trouble since then. The corpse of the executed sweater, no matter how I changed its contours as it lay on the back seat of the car, had kept revealing various outlines pertaining to Trap Schiller, the grossness and obscene bonhomie of his body, and to counteract this taste of coarse corruption, I resolved to make myself especially handsome and smart as I pressed home the nipple of my alarm clock before it exploded on the set hour of 6 a.m. Then, with the stern and romantic care of a gentleman about to fight a duel, I checked the arrangement of my papers, bathed and perfumed my delicate body, shaved my face and chest, selected a silk shirt and clean drawers, pulled on transparent taupe socks and congratulated myself for having with me in my trunk some very exquisite clothes. A waistcoat with nacreous buttons, for instance, a pale cashmere tie, and so on. I was not able, alas, to hold my breakfast, but dismissed that physicality as a trivial contretemps, wiped my mouth with a gossamer handkerchief produced from my sleeve, and with a blue block of ice for heart, a pill on my tongue, and solid death in my hip pocket, I stepped neatly into a telephone booth in Colmont. "Ah, ah, ah," said its little door, and rang up the only Schiller, Paul, furniture to be found in the battered book. Horse Paul told me he did know a Richard, the son of a cousin of his, and his address was, let me see, 10 Killer Street. I'm not going very far for my pseudonyms. "Ah, ah, ah," said the little door. At 10 Killer Street, a tenement house, I interviewed a number of dejected old people and two long-haired, strawberry-blonde, incredibly grubby nymphettes. Rather abstractedly, just for the heck of it, the ancient beast in me was casting about for some lightly-clad child I might hold against me for a minute after the killing was over, and nothing mattered any more, and everything was allowed. Yes, Dick Skiller had lived there, but had moved when he married. Nobody knew his address.
"They might know at the store," said a bass voice from an open manhole near which I happened to be standing with the two thin-armed, barefoot little girls and their dim grandmothers.
I entered the wrong store, and a wary old negro shook his head even before I could ask anything. I crossed over to a bleak grocery, and there, summoned by a customer at my request, a woman's voice from some wooden abyss in the floor, the manhole's counterpart, cried out, "Hunter Road, last house." Hunter Road was miles away, in an even more dismal district, all dump and ditch and wormy vegetable garden, and shack and grey drizzle and red mud and several smoking stacks in the distance. I stopped at the last house, a clapboard shack, with two or three similar ones further away from the road and a waste of withered weeds all around. Sounds of hammering came from behind the house, and for several minutes I sat quite still in my old car, old and frail, at the end of my journey, at my grey goal, Finis, my friends, Finis, my fiends. The time was around 2. My pulse was 40 one minute and 100 the next. The drizzle crepitated against the hood of the car. My gun had migrated to my right trouser pocket. A nondescript cur came out from behind the house, stopped in surprise, and started good-naturedly woof-woofing at me. His eyes slit, his shaggy belly all muddy, and then walked about a little and woofed once more. I got out of the car and slammed its door. How matter-of-fact, how square that slam sounded in the void of the sunless day. "Woof," commented the dog perfunctorily. I pressed the bell button. It vibrated through my whole system. "Personne. Je ressens. Repersonne." From what depth is re-nonsense? "Woof," said the dog. A rush and a shuffle, and whoosh-woof went the door. Couple of inches taller, pink-rimmed glasses, new heaped-up hairdo, new ears. How simple. The moment, the death I had kept conjuring up for 3 years, was as simple as a bit of dry wood. She was frankly and hugely pregnant. Her head looked smaller. Only 2 seconds had passed, really, but let me give them as much wooden duration as life can stand. And her pale, freckled cheeks were hollowed, and her bare shins and arms had lost all their tan, so that the little hairs showed. She wore a brown, sleeveless cotton dress and sloppy felt slippers. "Well," she exhaled after a pause with all the emphasis of wonder and welcome.
"Husband at home," I croaked, fist in pocket.
I could not kill her, of course, as some have thought. You see, I loved her. It was love at first sight, at last sight, at ever and ever sight. "Come in," she said with a vehement, cheerful note. Against the splintery dead wood of the door, Dolly Schiller flattened herself as best she could, even rising on tiptoe a little to let me pass,
and was crucified for a moment, looking down, smiling down at the threshold, hollow-cheeked, with round pomettes, her watered milk-white arms outspread on the wood. I passed without touching her bulging babe. Dolly smell, with a faint fried addition. My teeth chattered like an idiot's. No, you stay out, to the dog. She closed the door and followed me and her belly into the dollhouse parlour. Dick's down there, she said, pointing with an invisible tennis racket, inviting my gaze to travel from the drab parlour bedroom where we stood, right across the kitchen, and through the back doorway where, in a rather primitive vista, a dark-haired young stranger in overalls, instantaneously reprieved, was perched with his back to me on a ladder, fixing something near or upon the shack of his neighbour, a plumper fellow with only one arm, who stood looking up. This pattern she explained from afar apologetically. Men will be men. Should she call him in? No. Standing in the middle of the slanting room and emitting questioning mms, she made familiar Javanese gestures with her wrists and hands, offering me in a brief display of humorous courtesy to choose between a rocker and a divan, their bed, after 10 p.m. I say familiar because one day she had welcomed me with the same wrist dance to her party in Beardsley. We both sat down on the divan. Curious, although actually her looks had faded, I definitely realized so hopelessly late in the day how much she looked, had always looked, like Botticelli's russet Venus. The same soft nose, the same blurred beauty. In my pocket my fingers gently let go and repacked a little at the tip, within the handkerchief it was nested in, my unused weapon. "That's not the fellow I want," I said. The diffuse look of welcome left her eyes, her forehead puckered as in the old bitter days. "Not who? Where is he? Quick!" "Look," she said, inclining her head to one side and shaking it in that position. "Look, you are not going to bring that up." "I certainly am," I said. And for a moment, strangely enough the only merciful, endurable one in the whole interview, we were bristling at each other as if she was still mine. A wise girl, she controlled herself. Dick did not know a thing of the whole mess. He thought I was her father. He thought she had run away from an upper-class home just to wash dishes in a diner. He believed anything. Why should I want to make things harder than they were by raking up all that muck? But, I said, she must be sensible. She must be a sensible girl, with her bare drum under her thin brown stuff. She must understand that if she expected the help I had come to give, I must at least have a clear comprehension of the situation. Come, his name! She thought I had guessed long ago. It was, with a mischievous and melancholy smile, such a sensational name. I would never believe it. She could hardly believe it herself. His name, my fall nymph. He was... It was so unimportant, she said. She suggested I skip it. Would I like a cigarette? No. His name. She shook her head with great resolution. She guessed it was too late to raise hell, and I would never believe the unbelievably unbelievable. I said I had better go. Regards, nice to have seen her. She said really it was useless. She would never tell. But on the other hand, after all, do you really want to know who it was? Well, it was... And softly, confidentially... Arching her thin eyebrows and puckering her parched lips, she emitted, a little mockingly, somewhat fastidiously, not untenderly, in a kind of muted whistle, the name that the astute reader has guessed long ago. Waterproof. Why did a flash from Hourglass Lake cross my consciousness? I, too, had known it, without knowing it all along. There was no shock, no surprise. Quietly the fusion took place, and everything fell into order, into the pattern of branches that I have woven throughout this memoir with the express purpose of having the ripe fruit fall at the right moment. Yes, with the express and perverse purpose of rendering. She was talking, but I sat melting in my golden peace, of rendering that golden and monstrous peace through the satisfaction of logical recognition, which my most inimical reader should experience now. She was, as I say, talking. It came now in a relaxed flow. He was the only man she had ever been crazy about. What about Dick? Oh, Dick was a lamb. They were quite happy together, but she meant something different. And I had never counted, of course. She considered me as if grasping all at once the incredible and somehow tedious, confusing and unnecessary fact that the distant, elegant, slender, 40-year-old valetudinarian in velvet coat sitting beside her had known and adored every pore and follicle of her pubescent body. In her washed-out grey eyes, strangely spectacled, our poor romance was for a moment reflected, pondered upon, and dismissed like a dull pie.